confirm. There we go. Okay, thank you very much. You'll all get a continue or leave. I hope you can stay and continue with us. The freewheeling session at the end will not be recorded. And so if you've got some questions that you think should not go on public record, then hold them for that. I do hope that we will have the panel for about an hour to an hour 10, something like that. And there'll be plenty of time left over at the end for general questions and answers. So yes, as Lynn said, I'm the portfolio holder of the for the association chair and directors membership service, I guess you would call it. And so basically what I, this was actually created by Lynn quite a number of years ago, and she was the first holder, I think, of it. She suggested by her as a way, chairs are the last line of faculty members under the collective agreement. Well, your deans are management excluded. And so you have the collective agreement at your back. And the part of the role of my position is to consult with you about what your rights and obligations are under the collective agreement on a very base level, but also to try to create some kind of dialogue between chairs and carry ideas from one chair to another. Especially during COVID times, it's been very hard to have a kind of fluid exchange between chairs and problem solving and tips and tricks for the business. And so I end up moving those ideas through the chairs if you are willing to talk to me. So I'm totally open for consultations anytime. You can send me an email. I respond as quickly as I can, but certainly within 24 hours. Normally we set up a little meeting if I can't give you the advice directly by email. And I would like to think that since I've been doing this for a little over a year, it's been helpful for chairs. I certainly know that my predecessors in this position were extremely valuable for chairs. In fact, as a chair myself, I had some interactions with faculty association, I believe, through this kind of process. So, okay, so that's me. I forgot to say why am I even remotely qualified for this. I was a chair of mathematics and statistics from 2010 to 2015, approximately. And all chairs live in hard times. The hard times in those years were we were under budget cuts. So departments were being asked to remove 3% and then 2% and then another 1% and so on an annual basis from their budgets. And this led to, for example, loss of positions in math and statistics and similar things and other, a lot of loss of staff people and lab people in science units. And so this was really challenging. And now the challenge is different, but in some ways even more difficult, the challenges of COVID and completely rejigging the university and your colleagues in the online setting and making sure that the programs go forward in an effective way. So all chairs have challenges, but let me close off by saying, I've never met a chair who said it was all bad. There's a lot of things to like about being a chair. There's a lot of satisfaction, even when the problems are hard and unpleasant to sort out. Doing so is quite rewarding. And so every week, I think, as when I was chair, every week something happened that made me happy that I had been there and engaged in the problem and came to some sort of resolution. So with that as a sort of semi-positive closing, let me move to introducing the panel. We'll just scan the agenda here. So as you see, we're going to have a panel discussion under item 4. So this is structured. I'll introduce the panel. Just after that, I'm going to run through the participants list and get everybody who's here to just acknowledge, show your face and say which unit you're coming from, and are you a chair, a recent chair, or are you about to become a chair? So we'll do that after the panel. Okay, the panel. We've found four either experienced sitting or recently moved on chairs for you. So let me call on Catherine Collis, to say a little bit about her experience being what she was and when she was.
Okay. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Lynn, for inviting me. And I'd like to start by saying how grateful I am for the Faculty Association. It is a big help to have the Faculty Association behind us as chair, actually. So I'm really grateful, or I was anyway when I was chair. So my first time as chair was from 2008 to 2013. And 2008, I had just been promoted to associate prof when I became chair at the same time. So that was an interesting challenge. And the second time, I became chair in January 2019 after basically agreeing to be chair mostly because the person who we thought was going to be chair decided not to be. Nobody wanted to do it. Colleagues came to see me and said, would you consider doing it again? And I said, yes. And it's interesting because I'm going to talk about how to say no. So I said yes. And the reason I took the decision last year, after much discussion with my dean, Anna Lilac, to resign on December 31st, for many, not because being chair is an impossible task at all, but for a lot of personal reason that I'm not going to go into right now. So I'll have a lot of positive things to say, as well as challenges, of course. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine. Great to have you on. Michael McGuire.
Hi. I was made chair of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering in 2016. I'm another one of these associate professors serving as chair. It's been a lot of work, but if you want to have a major impact upon your department or unit, the chair is a good position. It lets you get a sort of sky-eye view of your department and how your faculty is run, how universities run. There's a lot of rewards for it. It's a lot of work. There's some frustrations. You're going to hear a lot about the frustrations today, unfortunately, but there's a reward for doing it as well. So I encourage people to do it. And I'm talking about assigning service jobs. So I'll be talking about some of that. It can't all be negative, otherwise we're in deep trouble. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Okay, Ulrich, I saw you come in. Haven't seen your face yet, but could you turn on your video? And
my video is on. My sound should be on now too.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would just like to echo Catherine in thanking the Faculty Association for all the work that you're doing, also for chairs. You have been extremely supportive, Lynn, Reuven, and Helga. To me, in my department, to faculty in my department, help solving complex issues. And I really appreciate the gatherings that you typically have with chairs, because in my view, the exchange among chairs is extremely important, because you get ideas how other departments are run that might stimulate thinking on your own part. Therefore, thank you very much for all your work. I have been chair from 2015 on in the Department of Psychology. I was also not very well interested in taking on this position, but nobody wanted to be chair. I was afraid that I was very ill-equipped in terms of my skills to run a department. And like with most of my scientific predictions, it turned out to be correct. And I think that what Michael says is also something that I come to appreciate. Being a chair gives you a lot of insights in university policy, and you can have some impact on the department. I think it's more limited, but perhaps I was just not good enough. And I also liked the finding good solutions to complex problems that can be very satisfactory. And I'll already think like an administrator, but if you can increase the operational efficiency of the department, I find this very satisfactory, satisfactory, not something that I would have predicted 6 years ago. But there are some perks also with respect to supporting faculty, junior faculty in particular, and students that you can do. And there are, of course, a lot of challenges. Not all hard problems are necessarily good hard problems, but I leave this for later. Thank you.
Thanks, Ulrich. Jean-Paul.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's certainly a great pleasure to be part of this panel, and I'm echoing my colleagues here. I have really appreciated the Faculty Association's inclusion of chairs and directors in all kinds of capacities to understand the kind of work that we do as different and needing special forums like this. And I think it's great to be able to offer some little bits of wisdom to up and coming chairs, new chairs, because I certainly appreciated every little bit of mentorship or advice that I got along the way myself. I'm chair of Indigenous Education, which is a very new department. So the department was founded in 2016-17, and there was a search, external search for a chair. And that's how I came to UVic. So I kind of knew what I was getting into, but also didn't know a lot of what would be waiting for me as chair of a new unit. I had not had similar administrative experience prior to becoming chair of Indigenous Education. I was program coordinator of my old unit, which involved a lot of the same things in terms of course planning and scheduling and working with your faculty and things like that. But it was kind of a step in between a chair and the rest of your unit. So that was the closest to any experience I had. And coming in and learning how UVic operates and learning how this new department might operate was certainly new. Everything was new. I was new, the department was new, and you could get away with that for only so long, saying, oh, I'm new. I still feel very new, even though I've been here since 2017. I think there was this moment in our Faculty of Education when I realized at the chair and directors meeting that I was the chair with the most experience. And that felt really strange because it still feels very new to me. And I think somehow that just sort of happens. Time goes by and you look back and go, oh my gosh, how did we get here? So I guess I'll just leave it at that. And I'm looking forward to the dialogue and hearing questions from people later. And also learning from my colleagues. I'm hoping to pick up some more tips.
Thanks, Jean-Paul, and thanks to all of our panel members. I'll say that when we set up the topics to discuss, we ended up with a lot of challenges. And it was observed that where were we going to tell the new incoming chairs or directors what the good parts were? And I guess just spontaneously, they decided to do that. So that's out of the way, but I'm no doubt it will come up again. Okay, so I promised to just do a really quick run through with the participants. So one of the things that I learned as chair that was very rewarding was getting out and meeting the other chairs and learning about the campus. So if you're new to this business, getting to know who your comparables are in other units is really great, and it's a useful skill. So I've got a list here. I'll just call first names, and if you could just say where you're coming from. Caroline?
Hi, everybody. So my name is Caroline Cameron. I'm a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Microbiology. And I'm actually just going to be chair for a year while our real chair is taking a much needed sabbatical, administrative leave. So it's myself and two other people, and we're each going to be associate chairs and acting chairs. It's this complicated schedule, but I think it's going to work. And I'm happy to be here today. Thank you.
Thanks. I see Vicky Wyatt on the list here. Are you here, Vicky? I don't see you in the participants.
I'm here, but I'm not about to be a chair. I was here because I am interested in learning more about what chairs are experiencing.
Cool. That's great. That's what we're looking for. Timothy.
Yes. Hi. I'm Tim Naney. I'm the director of the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. I'm not sure if research center directors were actually invited today, but I invited myself. No, and I'm very happy to be here. I've been here since last August. So I'm very much learning. And to quote Churchill, I'm a very modest man and I have much to be modest about. So I'm looking forward to this.
Thanks for joining us. Jan Wood. Okay, don't see you there. Denise. Oh, no. Kimball.
Oh, well, thanks, Chris.
I feel like Chris. A school teacher taking attendance
here. My name is Kimball Ketza. I'm a faculty member with the Gustafson School of Business, and I've been term for about 14 years and full-time for about 3 years. And I'm going to be taking on a really cool experience of being a chair for an accreditation process that we've been working on starting in July. So I'm really, really looking forward to this panel discussion and hearing some stories. I'm all about storytelling, hearing stories. So I'm excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Jamie. Missing. Helen. Crookie. Hello.
Sorry, it's a little confusing. There's two of us. I'm Helen. I'll be the incoming chair in anthropology come July.
Thanks. Thank you. Stephen Lindsay.
Hi there. I'm Steve Lindsay. I'm a professor in the Department of Psychology. I've been at UVic for almost 30 years, which seems appalling. And I did do a one-year term as acting chair about 6 or so years ago. And I have signed up for another 3-year term.
Wow. Well done. Fraser Hoff. Okay. Martha.
All these kids are going to get demerits.
Oh, yes. It'll be noted. Martha.
Hi, I'm Martha McGinnis. I'm in the linguistics department and I'm in the midst of a chair selection process. So I've been, I guess, informed that I will be recommended by the committee. And but then there's a ratification. So we'll see. Maybe I'll be chair and maybe I won't. But anyway, I'm here to learn in case it happens.
Better to be prepared. Thanks. David Medler.
I'm David Medler. I've been fulfilling an interim role as an associate chair and will be going up for an interview for the associate chair starting for July 1 in psychology.
Ah, okay, good. We heard very good things about the role of the associate chair in psychology over the last year or so. So well done. Thank you. Rose, I saw Rose come in. Rose is a brand new to UVic and brand new chair.
Yes, I'm coming into the Department of Educational Psychology and Leadership Studies. And like Jean-Paul, I'm an external hire coming from the University of Minnesota, originally Canadian, but have had my career in the US.
Thank you and welcome to UVic and welcome to the group. Thea, I saw you there. Oh, you were in the chat.
Yes, hi. Hi, everyone. I'm Thea Caccioni, the Chair of Gender Studies. And I started in January 21, and I've learned that it's pretty unusual to start in January and you really hit the ground running, but I'm very grateful for this talk today. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe Andrew Wender is not here.
Okay. I'm sitting in for Andrew, Chris, because...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can say a few
words. Sounds like Adam.
Yeah, Martin. That's fine. Andrew Wender is the incoming director for the Religious Religion, Culture, and Society program, but he has a sabbatical this fall. So I am filling in as acting director for the program for the fall term. And I've also served in that role for a long time, from 2005 to 2015 or 14. And so I'm interested to hear how things might have changed over the last 5 years and see where everybody's standing. So ready to learn.
Thank you. Vasco, are you there?
Hi, my name is Vasco. I'm the incoming chair in economics. I'm an external appointment. I've actually had previous experience in the UK. So I'm hoping to get there at some point and learn a lot more about UVic.
Thank you, and welcome to UVic. Alex Brolo.
Hello, so I'm Alex Brolo. So I'm a professor of chemistry, and I'm the acting chair in the Department of Chemistry in the process of trying to become the real chair. We'll see how that's going to work.
Good luck. Brad Buckham.
Yeah, hi, Brad Buckham. I'm in the Department of Mechanical Engineering. I've been at UVic since 2002, I guess, so been close to 20 years, and taking on an acting chair role in July. So excited to get lots of insight about what's been said here coming up for me in the summer.
Thank you. Kevin, I thought I saw Kevin Kerr here. Are you there from writing? No. Okay. Helen, the other Helen.
Oh, hello. And hello, Helen. Yes. I'm in French. I've been a director of an interdisciplinary program, medieval studies, with much pleasure. And I think that I'll be a chair as of next month. I have many doubts about that, and I'm very grateful to the Faculty Association, but also to all of you. And I used to be very grateful to my chairs in the department, because it seems terribly, not only challenging, but also boring to me. So I was pleased when you said, when I heard Ulrich said, oh, but there are rewards, and I was thinking, what could they be? Because it doesn't strike me as a rewarding position. But thank you for being there and convincing me that I had a limited view.
Thank you for your honesty, Helen. Okay, I hope you get some of the answers anyway. And the last one is Debbie. Is Debbie here?
No, Debbie's, a few people are registered but are getting the recording.
Right. I think in some cases they were here and want the recording, but okay. So Debbie, okay, very good. So we made it all the way through. Let's move.
I think there are, can I just interrupt for one sec? There are some people who aren't on the list who are here. So if any of them want to introduce themselves, that would be great.
Just.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I'm Peter Constable. I'm interim chair in biology, and but I've signed up for another 2.5 years, 3-year term, and I've just been ratified and in the department. So
congratulations.
So sorry for not making that list, Len and Chris.
Well, thank you for being here anyway. We won't kick you out. Okay. Any other? Yes. Hello.
And I'm Doris. I'm from the School of Chinese Care. I'm coming in as interim. My school is hiring for a director, and I'll be acting until that process is complete.
Thank you, and thank you for stepping forward. Anybody else? I've got a full screen here. I think I've seen.
It's Paul. Everybody. Paul.
Yep. Hi, everyone. Thanks for the invitation. I'm sorry I didn't make the list. That's not unusual for me. But I'm actually volunteered to be and it's kind of an interim associate dean graduate programs and research in the Faculty of Education. I've seen a number of Jean-Paul and sorry, I just forgot the person's name. He just stepped in, who's the chair now of Educational Psychology and Leadership. So just for 1 year, I currently work in the School of Exercise Science, Physical Health Education. So thanks for the invitation. It's wonderful to see everyone. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else? Looks pretty good. Okay, so if we can move now to the panel discussion. So what I'll do is I'll put the topic on the table and then call on one of the panel members to address it. I'd like to keep each topic to 5 minutes because I think all of these topics are important. We want to get through them, but we also, more importantly, want to have a bit of a freewheeling discussion at the end. So let's move right into it. The first topic is how to balance your job as chair or director with your own career and, very importantly, with your family. And can I call on Jean-Paul to open that discussion?
Okay. Disclaimer, I'm probably really bad at taking my own advice, but I try. And I'm really grateful that there's another topic on saying no, because I think that's we can expand on that a bit. And that's one of the things that becomes important, is being able to turn down things. Like, I don't think I've done an article review in a year and a half or something, but there's certain things that I think you prioritize and say, you know, I've got to get this done for my department and I have these other things going on, so I have to be able to compartmentalize a little bit. And one of the ways I think, you know, when I came here, I actually had 2 shirt grants and I thought, oh, how on earth am I going to find time to do the research? And honestly, I haven't really found the time. I've had to ask for extensions and things like that. But one of the things I've been trying, and so it's worth a try, is to block off like a whole day, a week or something like that. And that's just your research time, or that's just non-chair activity. There might be some emergency things that come up, but so we've got this practice in our unit that there's a research and writing day and we don't schedule things in that time. Of course, I break that all the time when I say, oh, this is really important. Yeah, we should meet Friday morning about that. But I really do try to block off the time to be able to do the research and writing demands that come up. Where teaching's concerned, I've tried to, you know, pull the chair card a bit and select the courses I really feel like I want to do. And that will be admittedly a little bit easier for me to do, so that I'm not spending as much time with the planning and prep for those courses. So one of the things I've done is an intensive course that's in June every year. So it's a little bit less admin busy, but then I can focus on the teaching at that time. And I'm done within that month. In terms of balancing with family, I think that one, you just have to stick to calendar time sometimes and just say, like, you know, I'm not available after 5 or something like that. Of course, anyone who's on this call and knows me and has gotten emails from me at 3 a.m. and knows, like, I'm just terrible at this, but I think you can kind of say, like, no, that's my time when I have to do this family thing. I know that I've even scheduled in drop off and pick up times for kids like that, but then I'm fully available these other times for the chair work that has to be done. And I know there's many other things. I don't know if like someone else on the panel would like to jump in and share an idea or two. Chris?
Maybe a good idea if we take a pause, if there are any questions on what you just...
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I noticed as chair pretty quickly was that compared to a faculty member where you pretty much have control of your own personal schedule and your professional schedule, chairs do not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you've moved around.
I just wanted to say thank you for that. One thing I found challenging is in this world of Zoom, I just had this happen this week where I'm supposed to be doing a humanities town hall at 5 o'clock. I have a 5-year-old. I'll be on my own with her this week. And when I tried to reach out to my colleagues to say, you know, does anyone else want to do this for me, which I haven't done yet as chair, it was my first time asking, you know, they said, oh, it's gender studies. Like, what's the problem with seeing a kid? Or, you know, and I think there's kind of this expectation now on the online setting that you should be able to parent and work at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you on that. I think that that's certainly something that happens. Being in Indigenous education too, I think that we have a kind of a relaxed view of those things too, which also means sometimes there's that burden of additional responsibility. But I like to think that we've tried to do things to make our work accommodating. I guess I can't really be the judge of that. I hope that my colleagues feel that way. And open to, you know, including family and things as you need to. I remembered just now as you were talking too that I had another note down that I was going to address and I forgot, which was about delegation. And that's another thing that's really important to managing your time, I think, and balancing is effective delegation. So when there's those kinds of meetings like that where you know that I can't be fully present there, can someone else attend on my behalf? And I've had to do it a few times. I'm amazed sometimes how much our colleagues will stand up and do those things. So I really appreciate that they do that. And to just trust that folks have got things. So like our graduate advisor, I will lean on them to do just about everything around graduate programming and only be included as I need to be, but to know that they've got it, most of that stuff. They're almost like an associate chair in how much they do for the graduate programs. So delegation obviously is a really key part of that too. And not being afraid to ask for that help when you need it. I think we sometimes think, well, I have to be there, but yeah, you don't always have to be there.
Very good. Thanks, Jean-Paul. And we'll want to move on, but you might want to, if there are additional questions about this, you might want to bring them up in the open question and answer part. We can return to that. And this topic could go on for the whole 2 hours, as experienced chairs know, but let's move on. Second topic is, how do you say no
as a chair? So it's a good follow-up on Jean-Paul's discussion. The first thing is, and it's super important, never say yes right away. People will come with tons of questions, sometimes unreasonable expectation. Don't say yes. So I would, listen, be empathetic, let your colleagues know that you care about their request and that you're going to investigate and come back to them. Sometimes, if the request is actually quite unreasonable, and you will get sometimes some unreasonable request, ask your colleagues to do some investigation on their own and to get back to you. Typically, they will not, because they will realize that their request is actually unreasonable. So it's a way to get away from it. There's the importance of saying no to the higher administration and to your faculty. I'm sorry to say, but we have sometimes associate deans who are really excited about tons of different things. So, and sometimes we're being asked to provide something. And I think Ellen will be good at that as well. We come from a similar cultural background. And I would typically ask, so why do we have to do that? Is it a requirement? Is it necessary? And interestingly enough, in some cases, well, because we think it might, you know. So before I accepted to, and I'm talking about at the higher level, because sometimes it will impose some doing a review, doing some adding some documentation, doing some calculation, and you need, and I think it's fair enough that we need to know exactly why we're being asked to do it. And sometimes the reasoning is not very clear, in which case I have, and sometimes told my faculty, actually I'm not doing it because I don't see how it's going to change anything. It's rare, but you know, don't hesitate, like don't say yes because you feel like you have to do it. I think something that's super important is to be clear and transparent about budget, for instance, right? So I've talked about, but the money doesn't belong to us. We're in charge of a departmental budget. It's not our money. So it's fair enough for our colleagues to know what's in the budget. How much money do we get? And we don't get that much money. And I think once we are really clear about what's in the budget, for instance, then it can mitigate those unreasonable expectations. Often unreasonable expectation revolves around money, right? I'm doing that. Can you provide so much money? The other thing as well is through email, and that goes back to what Jean-Paul was saying, right? We're not doctors. There's no emergency. We're not saving lives. So we don't have to be answering email all the time. I think it's fair enough after, we can decide that after 8 p.m. or even after 6 p.m., we're not going to answer emails. And often, and it's actually super important not to, if the request that comes through email, you know, makes you hesitate, it's a good idea not to answer right away and to take the time to think about it and to let, because I feel that, and I've done that, I'm like Jean-Paul, I have lots of good advice and sometimes I haven't followed my own advice, is that if we start answering emails right away or trying to serve people right away, and that includes your dean's office or the higher administration, then there's an expectation that we will always be doing it this way. So I think it's good to set some boundaries. And actually to go back to what Jean-Paul was saying, because it's related to the idea of saying no, is that in terms of balancing, I've always kept a day for research, a day where I don't come to campus so that I'm not in the office. And I would block in the calendar, you know, from 8 to 6, I would block research. Because what's going to happen as well is, and that didn't happen the first time, and that's sort of new, but because we have an open calendar, what Lynn was mentioning, that the VPAC office organized a lot of different workshops, a bit too much, I think. And so they, as soon as you're on the chair list, your calendar gets all those invitations, right? It's a bit overwhelming when you're a new chair, you get invited and you feel like you have to attend, but we can't, we cannot be everywhere. So don't just, there's a little button says decline, just decline and it's gone. And if it's something that you don't think is going to really change your work, then it's, I think it's better to decline than be frustrated because you just, in so many workshops, and it takes time. And it seems that the difference between the first time I was chair and the second time, and that might be my own feeling, but I feel like that there are so many new roles at the high administration that they maybe need to justify their presence. So they're creating all those workshops and meetings and all that. And I didn't have that the first time. And that was different. So, you know, there's no obligation. They never say anything when you decline. It's not going to change your department. And I agree with Lynn. Really, the first job is to be here for your colleagues and your department. And they might not agree with that, but really that's the first job. So.
Thank you, Catherine. Okay, we're just getting a little bit behind in my ambitious schedule here, so I'll just save any questions for the question and answer period. The next topic is assigning service jobs in your unit. How do you do it? Michael, could I call on you to address this?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, a lot of good advice floating around out there. So I hope my advice is at least half as good and then I'll be doing great. service jobs are you know, getting people to do them is not sometimes as easy as it should be. You know, really what happens is, you know, we have a lot of duties in our departments and we want to get an equitable distribution of work. And there's a lot of things that have to be done for our academic unit to operate. A danger we have, I'm not sure if your departments work this way, but we've seen it in mine, is you get the service jobs go to, I like to call the usual suspects, the same group of people over and over and over again. That leads to an unequal work distribution. It leads to possible favoritism, which is not good. So you need to get that spread out. So hopefully I'll give you some hints. You've got some overextended faculty members doing too much internal service. People to bring up are associate. Now that we have that CPI deadline for a certain number of years as associate professor, and then it disappears, there are a lot of associate professors, I know in the Faculty of Engineering, I've heard rumors in other faculties as well, who are running out of that time and they need to get promoted. And if they want to get promoted, they have to unfortunately get pulled back. So what happens is it should be, I mean, I think the philosophy is okay, or at least I was told when I got hired, is assistant professors shouldn't be doing as much service because they're trying to get promoted. And assistant teaching professors, assistant research stream professors are the same. You're establishing that record. So your job as chair should be to protect those people, because a lot of times they really, really want to get involved. They've got this new job and they've got a lot of exciting ideas, and this is good. I don't discourage them, but your job is to make sure that they don't do so much service duties that they're not able to get promoted. Because I hate to say it, I've seen unit standards. I've never seen a unit standard that says, oh, this person's research and teaching is not up to snuff, but look at what they're doing for blah, blah, blah in service. It's just not there. So you've got to protect them. And on the other hand, and I'll get more onto this a little bit later, some senior research stream faculty in particular just don't value internal service. So sometimes it's a little bit of a struggle to get them to do it. Just make a switch to my notes here. So one thing is motivation. Now, I know it's a little late now. We all last year went through this process of writing unit standards, but sometimes you have these going on review. So what we found worked in the Faculty of Engineering and in our unit is make sure it's clear in your unit standard that service is valued and a certain level of internal service is required. If you don't have that, make sure you have to obviously see what is appropriate for your department. We ended up for ours, we said, look, now I know our collective agreement says don't use the work breakdown per hours, but we're saying if you did, 20% of service, if you look at us, you know, our vacation time and all that comes to a certain couple hundred hours a year of service. And then we said, we don't require all that to be internal, but we're saying, look, explain to us that at least how did you do 1 or 2 weeks of internal service, right? To hit the expectations. Be very careful, be gentle, find out what's appropriate, but make sure it's clear in your unit standard. With that, make sure in your salary evaluations, when you get back, you write memos to these professors as chair, or if your evaluation committee is, you give to them feedback on what's going. Don't just make it a surprise. You didn't get expectation because you didn't hit the required internal service. That will get people rightfully upset. So make sure there's a feedback cycle going on there. Let's see, moving on here. Yeah, I mean, there is also the big stick and big carrot in the room. And that is alternative workload and evaluation records. So for us and our department, we're a reasonably large department. Our graduate advisor and our program director jobs are, I guess, undergraduate advisors for another department, are very, very heavy jobs. So we have alternative workload for them. So that's a reward. what you do is make sure when you do those AWL forms and such and memos that you have the list of duties clear. Otherwise, sometimes it may not be accepted higher up as you go through. Another thing we found useful, or I've heard other people in the Faculty of Engineering have done, is teaching stream faculty members are very, very good once they get promoted to associate professor, full professor rank, are very, very good for undergraduate advising roles. In fact, they often have seen more of the undergraduates than us research stream faculty members are. But there's two things you can do that works. You have to play with the collective agreement a little bit, is realize a lot of those roles have duties that can be considered teaching. So you can basically say, this person's not teaching so many courses because they're very involved in curriculum development, for example. So we find that's useful. And they're, you know, we've got crazy teaching loads and doing things like, if you're doing such coordination, you know, make sure you don't ask some teaching stream faculty member to teach the 8 courses I know some people have per year and be an advisor. That's insane. You'll just burn them out. So make sure you use that to go. Last thing I'll finish off with, hopefully get some questions, is that balance of internal and external service. For my problem in my department is those senior research stream faculty members. I mean, when we go to internal service, I get people saying, whoa, there's not enough duties to go around. Yet when we put a call out for, we're looking for a new graduate advisor, does anyone want to serve in the curriculum committee? They don't want to supply. They don't want to volunteer. And then they go, but I have all of this external service. I serve on these committees. I serve in my professional society, which is all good, right? We want to, because the university wants an international reputation. But for me, my opinion is senior faculty members, the people who've gotten full professor, who are no longer hustling to get that amount of research done to get to the thing, that's about the time you really should be thinking, and I'm speaking to the choir here because you're all chairs, to give back to the university more, volunteer, and do the work that helps this university run. I mean, you've got promoted to full professor. You're likely going to be here for another while. This is your home. Really, really get beyond just, you know, doing good research and doing good classes and get involved into it. Yeah. So basically, I think that's all I really have to say on that. I can take questions, or if anyone has comments, if they think I'm full of it,
I'll open the floor to one question, a short question if you have one, and otherwise make a note of your question and we'll bring it back to the discussion period. Okay, let's move on. The next topic is a huge one. Faculty evaluation. This is one of the things that chairs really worry about a lot in my experience. And so I wonder if Ulrich could speak to this, and we'll probably have to focus on one aspect of it, but to keep within our reasonable timeline.
Mm. The evaluation is multifaceted. On the one hand, you have the whole career progress evaluation, and on the other hand, you have a salary evaluation. And they are independent of each other to some extent. You need to have good, clear policies, departmental policies to evaluate faculty member. You have to be transparent in your processes. Therefore, we in psychology are a larger department, and we have, for example, committees for reappointment, promotion and tenure, and also for salary evaluation, which we separated just recently, these two aspects, because for a number of different reasons it's not recommended to have the same committee both decide over salary and promotion cases. And I could go into this more. From my perspective, what is really important when you deal with career progress, particularly of junior faculty, is to have regular meetings with them, to check in, not just at your May meeting when you discuss their career progress and write an annual review letter, but also beforehand, perhaps over the course of the year, twice or so. You don't want to go on their nerves either and make them nervous. Why does he check in on me all the time? In addition, I find it really helpful if in advance of your annual progress review with the faculty member, you ask the faculty to report on their last year, what went well, what didn't go so well, and on their plans for the next year. So if we have already an idea of what they're going to do, and then you can discuss it with them. Be constructive in your feedback. Clearly write in your letters, in your evaluation, whether they meet expectations, exceed expectations, or do not meet expectations, and give clear feedback on what they should focus on in the next year if their goals don't align with what you think is important. Therefore, it is really a lot about constructive feedback and a continual process with faculty, with junior faculty, that I think prepares them well for reappointment, tenure, and promotion, and then also for full professor. I mean, it's not as much mentoring is necessary, but that is a protracted process, not just a one-time meeting. I would leave it at this for the moment. It's more complex. If there are other questions, please ask them.
I think undoubtedly there'll be some very focused questions a little bit later. But thank you. You touched on many of the things I remember sort of developing and using, although we never had a committee in my department for salary evaluation. That was entirely the chair behind a closed door, which we can talk about as well. Okay, thank you very much, Ulrich. We have time for one question. Okay, it looks like the chairs would like to move on. So next topic is academic integrity. Michael, would you be able to say a few words about that?
Yeah, I guess I'll start off with, I think basically one thing that can help a lot is start with getting a culture of integrity, which is appropriate for your discipline, and get that clear to the students. Like so many things in this life, prevention works much better than a cure, or in this case, punishment. If your students should know a priori clearly what is expected of them and why it's expected of them. We're in engineering, so we're a professional program, so we can go to, the engineers and geoscientists of BC and the appropriate professional societies and say, this is what's going on and what is going to be really going to be expected to you once you leave these doors. We started from orientation sessions in engineering. We hit it again in our core classes, particularly our design stream classes, which is our big, we have one every year, and we go into the students and say, look, here's what plagiarism, for example, means to engineers and why it's such a bad thing. And, as well as, just on what unethical behavior is and why our society treats it so badly. If you go into the process of academic integrity, obviously there is what you've got in the calendar. I'll just sort of go briefly through that and go into my addition on that. Obviously, this is also something that's coming more and more important this year. Unfortunately, due to online classes, we are getting a lot more students who are trying stuff that they would never do because, I'm at home, I'm writing the exam. I've got to say, I have had professors who I have everyone with their camera on and I'm watching them while they're writing exams. I got to say, I'm not a big fan of that. it may work for some people, but I particularly for upper year classes, I prefer, to build the culture up. Now, so for the process that starts, if you look at it in the calendar, it starts with the instructor of the class sending a memo to the chair and describing a possible integrity violation. I prefer a formal memo instead of forward as just an email, because that eventually could be, if there's an appeal, the student could, get access to that paperwork. So make sure that memo, or at least has included with it the evidence, because, if you're going to make decisions and you're going to have effects upon students, it's clear. So make sure that's going to the students. After that, once it gets to my office, I'm using the model that it's the chair who makes a decision. Some departments have a committee. I think computer science does that. So they would have a process for the committee. So I'm just dealing with if you're sitting on your own. You send a memo to the student describing what the potential violation is and what the evidence outline of what the evidence of it is. And the student, tell the student how they can contact your office and arrange for a meeting. in that memo, you would also tell them that, you know, with the process, that they're allowed to bring a witness and let them know, okay, if you want more about the constitution, here's where on the university they can see, find out more about this process. Then you have the meeting with the student. Now, the big thing I want to bring up to this meeting is you as chair are gathering evidence. You should not have made a decision at that point as to whether an academic violation has occurred. It's a fact-finding portion of that, this procedure. So you should attend as chair. Maybe the committee attends if you have a committee that does it. The chair, again, the student gets to bring a witness along to make sure that, you know, that's listed in the calendar to make sure that we're not. My big thing is at the beginning of the meeting, I explain what the process is, why I'm doing, that I haven't made a decision yet, basically how the process, and then I give the student the ability to explain what's going on, you know, from what happened from their side of the decision. After the meeting is when you make a decision on whether you believe a violation has occurred. And you deal with consequences. Now, you may notice what I didn't discuss in there was there's what's a little unclear in the policy is exactly what is the required level of evidence for determining if an academic violation occurred. And I believe that's on purpose to give us a little bit of leeway on that. It's not, by the way, I've heard this is quite clear, I've heard from it, is not beyond a reasonable doubt. that's not the level we're required to. And then there's balance of probabilities. My thing is, don't get biased. Now, if you look into it, there was, when I started as chair, there was a system where they said, oh, check on this email. There's an academic integrity office to see if the student has had a prior violation. Now their process is don't check with that office until after you have determined. That is so you're not biased. Prior bad acts of the student or alleged bad acts of the student should not affect your decision on that case. It should be just what do you see in front of you right now? I know that's going to be hard because sometimes it may be the student showing up to your office again, but yeah. And so my guideline for evidence is it's a function of what level of the student is and where they are in their academic career and what is the consequence. So for example, if I am looking at a first year student, and they're just been caught on a minor quiz, which is small percentage, I don't have as high as a standard because I'm only going to hit the student for a small percentage of the class and I want to get them a warning. I'm a little lighter and lower your students because they're still feeling out. When you get to the higher level students, my standard gets a little more severe because what you have there is sometimes, say, take example, cheating on a final exam. The consequence in the calendar can be up to just fail the course. So if I'm going to fail a course in a senior year course, I want to make darn sure I know that the student did a violation because that's going to have a major consequence for them. This is nothing in the policy. This is just me. Some people may disagree with me, but that's where I go. Now, so first offense, as I said, is usually 0% on the assignment unless it's something like plagiarizing on a report, in which case a full report, major plagiarization of the report, majority of the report is plagiarized, in which case it can be 0% on the course. Then obviously you inform the IU check. Now, if it's a second offense after you've made the determination, it's out of your hands because second offenses are always dealt with at the dean's level. So that means you've got to gather all of the evidence, usually saying, I believe a violation occurred in this case, and then you send it to the dean. So for us in engineering, that would be the associate dean undergrad. For a graduate student, that would be the dean of the faculty of graduate studies or the appropriate associate dean of the faculty of graduate studies, and they'd make a decision. One thing you got to watch out for is sometimes students are playing games. One thing I have had happen in engineering is a student says, I'd like you to give me this penalty, the lower penalty, because then what I can do is I'll withdraw from the course. So the penalty disappears off my transcript. And there's no consequence whatsoever. And so you've got to be aware sometimes that does happen. And you got to decide in yourself what you're going to do in that circumstance. Because you will have students who basically they want to make sure that that penalty doesn't appear in any form. We're lucky as a university, by the way, in my opinion. We're not one of these universities that makes academic misconduct as a notation on the student's transcript in most cases. Some universities do have special grades where there's fail and then there's fail due to academic misconduct. UVic doesn't have that. There is some people who are asking for it. I believe I've heard officially that we could, but if you want to do that, oh boy, would it have to be a major offense, and it would require the Senate to explicitly vote that that student gets notation, which was shorthand for it never happens. I don't even want to know what the student wouldn't have to have done. I guess I sort of went brief over it. Is there any questions or concerns or someone might have about that or comments?
Yeah, again, we could have one quick question and then roll everything into the question and Q&A part. Mm-hmm. Anybody?
I'm just wondering how, my understanding was that you would have to know if it's their first, second, or third, or, you know, no prior violations before being able to make a decision. Are you just saying not to ask before the actual meeting?
You got it. You got it. So what happens is, yeah, because when I first started as chair, I found a paperwork that said, here's what you're supposed to do. That document disappeared because it was before you start, they said, this is 5 years ago, check if there's a previous violation. If there's a previous violation, you as chair, it all goes to the dean and the dean makes a decision. They've changed their mind now. Now they say, look, associate deans don't have enough time for this, or deans don't have enough time for this. Do the investigation inside of the department. And then after you've done the investigation, and you've determined that a violation has occurred, then you go write the email to the academic integrity office. And if the email comes back saying, this is the second time for this student, then you go, oh, I can impose a penalty. Because second violations, those are severe. That's like full on fail a course, academic probation, or sorry, miss, what's it called? There's a probation that's not for low grades, but for bad behavior or something. We as chairs don't have the power. It has to be a dean to impose that. So everything goes to the dean. You will tell the dean, here's what's happened. Usually the dean in many cases will say, I want to meet with the student again because it's a major violation. Like I could be kicking you out of a program. So I want to be darn sure I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Is that cleared up?
Yes.
Second violation, a mark does go on the transcript. So it requires a higher level of authority, I think.
Yeah.
For 5 years. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was a terrifically helpful. Everything I ever thought about it was included and more. So thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
Okay, next topic. Special challenges for smaller units, and Catherine's perfect person to address this, coming from French, one of our great smaller units.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, thank you. It is a great unit indeed. So I've decided to talk about challenges and also to talk about opportunities, the advantages of smaller units, because I was thinking if we talk about all the challenges, nobody's going to want to be chair anymore, which is not a good thing. So one of the challenge, which actually also can be a good thing, is that typically you know your colleagues really well. So because really being chair, there's a lot to do with human relationship, right? So sometimes you know them, you might be friend with some of your colleagues. So it's a smaller unit. And so you need to establish boundaries, right? Because now you're in a position where you might have to say no, like I talked before. Or like Michael was saying, then you face with the challenges of distributing a service. And Michael is completely right that often newer colleagues are really keen on doing everything, and you have to be super careful not to overburden junior colleagues. And sometimes you might have senior colleagues who are okay with letting junior colleagues do things. So it's really a balancing act. And sometimes I find when you, because you know your colleagues really well, it makes it a bit challenging. Having said that, the advantage of a smaller unit, I was trying to think, is that you know them, it's easier to establish a conversation. So what I did last time, I did that the first time, but what I did last time is I made meetings with each of my colleagues and I asked them the same question. What are the expectations in regard to, you know, how I can help as chair. So I had a series of two or three questions, and I met them individually in my office. I never closed the door unless someone wants the door closed for privacy. I always leave the door slightly open. And it was super useful because I discovered that some colleagues had in their mind, they thought they were doing way more work than everybody else. But then when we discussed and I said, well, look, this is, you know, what you've taught or, you know, the services you've done, it's actually kind of, you know, you're meeting expectation. So then I could talk to some of my colleagues, for instance, on the value of, you know, this, we're all doing the same work. Some people are faster at doing the same work, meaning they have better strategy, right? It's not about how many hours you spend doing work. It's actually what you're doing. So to go back to the idea of smaller unit, I could spend more time individually when I started and understand what the expectations were. Being in a smaller unit, one of the challenges is at the faculty level or sometimes at a higher level. And again, that's newer, and Lynn, who has been here a long time, will probably know exactly what I'm talking about, is sometimes we get profiled as a small unit, or we get profiled, for instance, Department of French or the language department. Well, we're not a language department. Teaching language is only one little portion of what we do. Hélène, for instance, doesn't teach language. You know, it's about literature, culture, linguistics. We do other things. So there's a tendency to profile, and there's a tendency, it seems, at least in our faculty, and again, I'm sorry to say that, but that's the reality, to make decisions according to metrics. The problem is that those metrics, and that's where you have to be able to say no or to challenge those metrics, because statistics have to take into account the context, you know. So sometimes those metrics that are calculated don't work well for units that have less faculty members, who have more courses with less students for pedagogical reasons. So so sometimes being in a smaller unit makes you compete with bigger units, and we should not. In theory, we should not have to compete. Numbers, for instance, of students are calculated at a faculty level, yet we get, you know, there's a tendency for at chairs and directors meeting, for instance, sometimes to list numbers per department. So, you know, it's like showing off some departments against others, right? So you have to make sure that you don't get influenced by all those comparative factors or those metrics, or that you resist the metrics in a sense as much as you can. So I found that was the biggest challenge for smaller units. Another challenge is that to do with staff. And again, staff are being removed from department according to some metrics that in my mind make no sense. But that's the reality, right? And sometimes we cannot do anything about it. So it can be difficult when you have only one person, one staff, which is basically what's happening with smaller units. The good thing about smaller units, it's easy to organize departmental retreats. And those, we've had some, I think, successful one. I don't know if Hélène agrees with me, but I think we've had some good departmental retreats. It's easier to organize, and there's nothing like being together with good food in a room to discuss, you know, how we can make the department work better. So that's easier to organize with in a smaller unit. But the biggest challenge is definitely that balance, what Michael was talking about, the balance of service and finding. I think there's a tendency, and that was probably my problem, to just do it all, because you don't want to be always asking your colleagues to add to their service load. So I think I'll stop here, and I'm sure there will be questions later on.
Thanks, Catherine. Let's move to the last two topics here. The second to last, working with Indigenous faculty. Jean-Paul, could you say a few words about that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. And I'll try to answer this question with specifics about Indigenous faculty in our unit, but I hope that some of the things I'm sharing have application even beyond if you don't have Indigenous faculty. And it goes back to some of the things that were being said earlier in terms of clarity and policies and how important it is to be transparent and clear and all of that. So, and participation of your unit. So one of the things that I've found advantageous to our Department of Indigenous Education and being able to have a group of like-minded scholars and folks who are all Indigenous at this point, is that we can get together easily and work on these things. Like Catherine was mentioning, those retreats with a small unit that are much more likely or able to happen, I think, than some of the larger groups where there's perhaps some divisions that exist, disciplinary divisions or otherwise. As a small group, we can meet, we can talk over things. So one of the first things I was able to do as chair was put a practice together with my colleagues that sought consensus in our unit for decision making. And rather than have like a votes and Robert's rules and things like that, we can work with a modified kind of circle approach. And in that way, we ensure that all the voices are heard, and consensus doesn't necessarily mean we're all agreeing, but it does mean that we are working through processes of hearing every voice and ensuring everyone has a chance to talk about whatever topic it is that's under discussion. And so when the unit standard came up for renewal, I guess as a new unit, we've actually gone through two unit standard processes. One being because of the more recent collective agreement and having to revisit what we had in our unit standard. But it gave us the opportunity to really define clearly what is Indigenous scholarship and what we see counts as Indigenous research, Indigenous scholarship. How is it different from service or from teaching contributions and that sort of thing? And I feel like that's one of the areas that has been a real opportunity for us to be very clear about this notion. And there have been some really great guidelines at UVic in terms of community engaged scholarship. So we could use that as a starting point and then talk about some of those things that our colleagues do that sometimes get explained away in a different way. Like, is that work that you're doing service or is it scholarship? Is it research activity or is it something else? So by laying it out in our unit standard with an appendix that says the following things are considered scholarly activities, and we could talk about some of the cultural contributions that some of our members have to make sometimes as something that's not mere service, but it's something beyond that. I think Paul's on this call and he's talked about cultural taxation that kind of occurs on the part of Indigenous faculty who often have to take on additional mentorship of students and explaining what Indigenous realities are to different folks in the university and how that can take its toll and takes away from you doing the work that you're here to do. So folks will just pop in to say, oh, you know, I've got this question for you about Coast Salish culture, and then you're spending half an hour explaining how you're not from Coast Salish culture, but nonetheless explaining where you learn these things. And so, we have this opportunity to include some of those concerns about additional responsibilities, activities that Indigenous faculty end up doing. And I think by having the clarity in the unit standards really helped us when we look for external reviews of promotion cases, or it's very clear and laid out what it is we're talking about. And this required us doing a kind of a canvassing of other universities and what they do. What does UNBC do? What does Trent University do? Places that have strong Indigenous studies departments, how do they define things? So a bit of a scoping of what's around and figuring out what would work for us, and a lot of discussion. So took a lot of time to get our unit standard through, and COVID was part of it, but so was just the time to just to let things percolate, think through what will happen if we word it this way, what if we do it this way. And I like something that Catherine said earlier about when you're saying how to say no and about taking time. I feel like that's such an important thing when you're chair, is to don't feel rushed doing these things, because the extra time you take can make something work a lot better. And I don't know how many times I've felt like we're up against a deadline and it's like, you must do this now. And if you just stand back and go, do we have to do it right now? You actually end up with something that's a little bit, it's going to last longer. It's going to work better. And rushing things is not always in our best interest. Anyway, that was all over the place, but I'm happy to talk more in the questions too.
Thank you. Many units now are in a position where they need to start thinking about this. And those unit standards that you have might be a pretty good resource document for people to sort of just get a beginning of an understanding. If it's possible to share those, if somebody approaches you and you could share those.
I'm always happy to share them, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, last topic, faculty and staff hiring best practices. Ulrich said he could speak to that. And Ulrich, I'll just ask you, we're eating into our Q&A.
I will be short. Nevertheless, I would like to just reinforce what Catherine and Jean-Paul have said about taking time, because often as a chair you feel rushed, and I have to say my worst decisions were made when I made them quickly, too quickly. And the need is always, as a chair, you want to get something off your plate because there's so much, but it is advisable not to rush decisions. I learned that painfully, and I'm still there's some learning I would have to go through. Okay, hiring. Faculty hiring, it's really important that you make clear that you have some kind of departmental idea, if possible, of where you want to move with your hiring. Sometimes you have flexibility in terms of hiring, what area of research expertise you want to look at. Consider equity seeking groups and hiring those. In our department, we have had 3, 4, 5, I don't know, over the last 3 years. And that requires a departmental discussion, I think, to get buy-in. And of course you have some criticism, but it should be a clear vote in your department if you want to move into expanding in terms of equity seeking groups in your department. The hiring process itself, I recommend, there's a lot of paperwork you have to go through, and the recruitment handbook, you have to read it. There's nothing, no way around it. There are all kinds of policies that you have to follow. You should have a search committee or search and appointment procedure policy in your department that stipulates how, whether the department as a whole or you have a selective search committee and so on. Make sure you have clear procedures there. With respect to search committee disputes, sometimes search committees can have infights, and as a department chair, you then have to intervene. And that is a very delicate matter, I have to say. The other point is, in terms of the actual search process, there's a lot of documentation that has to go on. Advertisements have to be placed, screenshots have to be made. Make sure the responsibilities are clearly distributed and determined. who does what, because you can have a failed search if you don't do it properly. Therefore, it's also the same as conflict of interest. Make sure that you replace faculty on a search committee where the one of the shortlisted candidates was a former graduate student or something like that. That make just sure to do this, because there can be all kinds of complications if you don't. As a chair for the search processes itself, you have a search committee. Therefore, I try not to intervene with what they select, who they select. I give my input in terms of what I think in our department we should be looking for, but other department members are invited to do so as well. I interview with the search candidates twice. I have the incoming, the first meeting when they have a job interview, and the last debriefing meeting. And then the job negotiations are an art by themselves. You need really to act often in a timely manner. One thing I learned as a chair is if you have a protracted job negotiation, if there's a lot of stuff that comes up again and again from a candidate, it will fail. Therefore, I'm not hesitant nowadays to set clear deadlines as to when they have to make a decision. Otherwise, we move on. And sometimes that's painful because you want to have a candidate, but I don't think it works out in the long run if it's just they play you if it takes too long. It's my feeling, at least. Therefore, the negotiation is a part by itself. It is really important that your dean and also faculty relations get back to you quickly when there's an offer that can be negotiated. Much more negotiation is possible than I ever thought. You're given a mandate as a department chair, but sometimes it goes beyond the mandate. You can make exceptions. You can completely rewrite policies. You can come up with alternative workload arrangements for a new faculty. I mean, a lot is really possible. Explore it. Explore if you want a candidate really. Explore what the candidate would like to get, and then see what is possible. I mean, some things like a startup budget in our department of 500,000 will not be possible, but there's sometimes surprises that things, it surprised me sometimes what is possible. If I were ever to go through a negotiation at UVic again, I would definitely negotiate a better term for myself. And with respect to staff hiring, I would suggest, you should have a clear allocation of responsibility and workflow within in your staff. We have a number of staff in psychology because we are a larger department, and our administrative officer essentially handles the whole staff hiring process and determines the needs that we have, job descriptions, job evaluations, something I thought I never had to deal with. I got not familiar with this whole job evaluation process. But I would still suggest that you chime in. You, at least at the interview process, you're there and you chime in the decision-making, for example, for a department or secretary, even a receptionist, because you have to work with these people as a department chair. And in addition, I mean, you work with your staff, and if your staff sees that you're disengaged with respect to all your staff, with respect to the staffing issue, that will have also ramifications and implications for their job satisfactory, how they work with you. They have already helped me to avoid so many mistakes because I try to be engaged with them. I think the work morale is better then as well. Therefore, I strongly suggest for a number of different reasons that you're involved in staff hiring processes, perhaps not necessarily in coming up with a short list of the candidates that are being interviewed, but during the interview process and talking to staff in the decision-making process, then I think you should get involved. And there are all complications with hiring of staff and how you advertise and who has priority and not priority and so on. I think an AO would be better equipped to talk about this, but you should inquire with AO. And sometimes it's also good to inquire with human resources about hiring processes. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Ulrich. I heard a lot of things in there that I wished I'd known when I started as chair about hiring. And I will say that hiring, at least in our department, has become more formalized rather than less in the last decade or so. We used to be a little bit more freewheeling, but we really now have aligned ourselves with best practices. One thing I'll mention is before you even get to the point of hiring, our department has a five-year hiring plan, which was really useful for the chair to know, and for the dean to know, for that matter, where the department might move next if you get there Monday morning and they say, hey, there's an open position now, you can go ahead and hire. Then you don't have to have this discussion. And it was quite a useful document to produce. I think it brought the department together in a very productive way to decide what you're going to do in the next 5 years. So I'll leave it at that. I want to really thank the panel members. I was kind of mesmerized as a former chair going through this, thinking, reliving all of these things that I learned to some degree from colleagues, but mostly I learned on the job. And I think you heard from our panel that they also learned many things on the job, but hopefully this process will streamline the learning a little bit for you and allow you to go even further than I did, for example, in running things in the best way possible for your colleagues. Okay, we have time now. Well, it's time to open the floor for discussion and to turn off the recording, Penny, if you